Meeting of the House Interim Revenue Committee, and welcome our Senate colleague, Senator Farioli. Glad to have you with us this morning.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And I'm keeping with the yellow sign on Kim's desk. I'm turning off my cell phone and encourage everybody to do likewise. Leading by example, we call it. Why we also don't have scones today. We're just serving coffee. We want to welcome everybody. We have the June revenue forecast. It's going to sound familiar, I expect, but I hope we can get some questions and a little bit more information perhaps than what we read in the newspaper and heard on the radio. So for that, I don't know, Paul, do we have anything that you want to touch on before we jump into the morning? Send it fast. Okay, well then let's do the forecast and welcome Tom Petowski back with us with a couple new faces. And if you want to introduce your colleagues to the committee, we'll hear from you on the forecast.
Yes, good morning. Chair Shetterly, members of the House Interim Revenue Committee, and Senator Farioli. Today is our official release of the June 2002 Economic and Revenue Forecast. And by the way, for the record, my name is Tom Petowski, State Economist with the Office of Economic Analysis. As I said, this is our official release for the June 2002 Economic and Revenue Forecast. Printed copies are available today and also off our website. You can get the full document downloaded. Today with me, to my left, is Michael Kennedy, our revenue economist with the office. And to his left is Ralph Shaw of Shaw Ventures, Incorporated. Ralph is the chair of our Governor's Council of Economic Advisors, very well known in the business community. And what I'd like to do is to have Ralph start off with some opening comments.
Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you, Tom. I would just like to give you a little brief insight into what the Governor's Council of Economic Advisors does and what people comprise the council. And then I'd be glad to answer any questions that you might have with respect to that, but I'm going to leave the details on the economic forecast to Tom and to Michael. The Governor's Council of Economic Advisors consists of 14 people, 11 of which are non-governmental people. We cover a broad range of the economy of the state and of the nation, ranging from agriculture to forest products to high technology. We have, it's made up of people with extended experience in the world of economic forecasting. We meet approximately twice every quarter. We speak with one another more frequently if it, there's something that demands our attention. We are avid users of email to transfer information that's going on in the state, the companies that exist in the state, and as we see international and national events affecting the revenues for the state of Oregon. The group meets once, typically in Portland, in which everybody comes in, and we talk about the changes that have taken place in the last 3 months and what we think that means for the state of Oregon's revenues and what we think is likely to take place in terms of inflation. We then meet in an official meeting down here in Salem once every quarter, and during that period of time, Tom and his group present to us the forecast that they have, and they ask us for comments on the forecast to see whether or not the forecast seems to fit what our particular analysis would suggest. So that's a very, in brief terms, what the Council of Economic Advisors does. If
any questions?
Then I would like to ask Tom then to speak to the forecast.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Yes, thank you, Ralph. I want to add, too, that these members of the Governor's Council of Economic Advisors are very well-known experts throughout their respective industries, and we try to cover all the industries possible. And also, all their work is volunteer work, except for some cookies. But other than that, it's all volunteer work, and they do freely give their time because they are truly concerned about the state of Oregon and want to give that as a public service. So I want to thank them for that.
Thank you.
With that, let me start with the economic forecast. I'm going to go fairly quickly so that we can then go into the revenue forecast. The Oregon economic forecast, as Ralph was describing to you, we have our process is that we first come up with an economic forecast that we have as and then we get a consensus to that forecast. Besides the Governor's Council of Economic Advisors, we also use what we call the DAS Advisory Group, Department of Administrative Services. That covers things like Department of Agriculture, Forestry, Consumer Business and Services, Employment Department, the Treasury Department, Human Services, from just about every type of agency throughout the state is a member of that, people that use our forecast. We have our, as Ralph described, our pre-meeting. We talk about the national forecast and also the latest information we've seen on the Oregon economy. We do our simulations and our models. We meet back at Salem. Insiders refers to the DAS Advisory Group. The outsiders is the Governor's Council of Economic Advisors. Then we finalize those numbers. Those feed in right to the revenue forecast. Economic and revenue models. This is a schematic where we use information about the U.S. economy. We also use the DRI WEFA National Forecasting Service to assist us in that matter. Governor's Council Advisory Meeting meets generally in Portland, as Ralph said. We discuss that. We then take a look through the Oregon economic history. We get a preliminary forecast. Then we meet with our advisory groups to review that forecast. We have our final then forecast for the economy. Then we bring in both our personal income tax models, corporate tax models, review those, a little bit of forecast judgment based both on what our committee members have told us about the economy, take into account legislative policy changes, and finally come up with that revenue forecast. The whole process takes about a month and a half for each quarter to truly go through it, although we are constantly monitoring what's going on.
Well, Tom, we hear from time to time during the period between each revenue forecast that there circulates a number that we hear the next forecast is going to be this, we hear the next forecast is going to be that. Where do those numbers come from in the in between?
Truly, those numbers are, in my mind, based on people's perception of what they're seeing is going on in the economy, and is not numbers coming from our office. What we do is, as we're getting closer to finalizing the numbers, we may be asked by the governor's office, I may contact Paul's office, to say, if things are looking about in a range of where these numbers might be, but they're not finalized yet. And so as we're coming up to that forecast, really it's I would say we're getting a sense as we finalize the economic numbers what the revenue numbers may fall into a range. So that is essentially about during the first week or the end really of the first week of the month before we release. So for example, we releasing today, May 31st, it was during sort of May 9th, we had our meeting with the insiders and outsiders, and so it's around that time that we're getting a better idea of what the range of numbers might be.
So anyone who relies on what they hear in between does so at their peril.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly. As you know, the nation's officially in recession. It's unofficially out of recession. There's a group that, National Bureau of Economic Research, that says whether it's in recession or not. Unfortunately, they decide generally somewhere like a year later when the actual date is, which isn't that helpful. But for historical terms, it is. So the economy peaked, as we can see down here. I think the two bottom parts are more relevant at the moment, where the recovery seems to have started in the first quarter of this year. Oregon is definitely in recession. We believe the start of the recovery, we expect it in the second half of this year. So a little bit of lagging of what we're seeing from the U.S. economy. Consumer sentiment, although this is kind of dark over here, this was January 2001. We had a sharp drop. This is the period of time where economists were saying, I think we're going to just skip and miss the recession, possibly. But we had September 11th events, another large drop into really recessionary territory for consumer confidence. But the good point is that we're starting to bounce above those pre-September 11th levels. Still below where we saw in terms of high points at the end of 2000.
What does consumer sentiment make?
Consumer sentiment is very much like what you hear in the news called consumer confidence.
Okay.
It's just that the there's a group called the Conference Board. It's a private industry group that reports the consumer confidence level. This is from the University of Michigan, which you don't have to pay for, but it tries to measure the same thing, and the name was already taken. They call it consumer sentiment. As we know, the Federal Reserve decreased interest rates quite dramatically. We're expecting later this summer, as the U.S. economy continues to recover, that the Federal Reserve will follow that recovery with slow rises in the interest rate. The opinion here is that the Fed truly believes the interest rates right now are too stimulative if the economy would start to recover. So they'll want to start to sort of match that as we go along. Recent news that recovery signals, first quarter GDP had been up quite a bit at 5.6%. The economic leading indicators are up. High productivity, this is a good sign. This generally means that some wage increases can happen without the cause of cost push inflation occurring, which is good news. Residential construction is up. When you get 40-year low mortgage rates, people buy houses. The non-residential is slow, and that's probably going to be one of the later parts to recover. Existing home sales are also up. Vehicle sales, as we know, they were strong in October. They're still up in 2002, but not the astronomical levels that we saw when the initial 0% financing took place. The ISM index used to be called the Purchasing Manufacturers Index, is also up, indicating that we're seeing manufacturing starting to recover a little bit. Unemployment rate for the U.S. is 6%. That's gone up, but it's truly a lagging indicator. I'll mention that a little bit later and for the Oregon information. And then the Consumer Confidence Index from the Conference Board is also rising. Oregon's economy. Durable goods manufacturing. You can see here that as a share of durable goods manufacturing of total output of goods and services, we're at 26.3%, rather high level relative to the other states and relative to the U.S. economy average. This is once again an indication that this is a manufacturing-based recession. We've got to hit harder than other states did. And part of it is that durable goods manufacturing is one of the more volatile sectors of the economy. It does very well in boom times and really gives you good jobs and high-paying jobs, but during downturns, it also comes down quite a bit. Manufacturing employment as a percent of total employment. Once again, Oregon is higher than our neighbors. I put Texas in here because Texas is usually seen as one of the spots where if high-tech is going to locate, it seems to be a neck-and-neck race sometimes between Austin and Portland. So I wanted to put them in with along with these states. But you can see that we're relatively high in that average also. Unemployment rates, we've had the distinction, I think, for the last 10 months of having the highest unemployment rate in the country. Having said that, sometimes we will point to states that have low unemployment rates, and I've heard that possibly we should look to these states and try to see what they're doing. Well, I think that speaks for itself. If you want to be a low unemployment state, do you really want to be North Dakota?
Well, no. Is that a motion? I think they're trying to get rid of that name, aren't they? maybe we can take it.
Exports was another area that we're dependent on. With this being a global decline, you can see that consumer electronics products, somewhere in the order of 45% of the total exports, fell by 31%. And this gives you also an idea, too, that it's across all our manufacturing base. Transportation equipment down 28%, wood products are down 22%. This is historical. You can see over here, this is the red corresponds to the time period when the U.S. is in recession. We've had basically flat growth in the first quarter of this year. This downturn's a little deeper than 90-91, but nowhere near as bad as 80-82 period. This is the latest we have in terms of regional unemployment for the state. The Portland metro area at 7.6%, our east of the Cascade areas at higher unemployment rates. And this is sort of traditional, but what we've generally seen in better times, the Portland metro area would have a much lower unemployment rate compared to these eastern counties. This is our outlook. Not much change from the March outlook. We believe that we'll be coming out of the recession in the second half of this year. We will have more mild growth rather than this very strong growth in the mid-1990s. We will follow the U.S. and be slightly stronger than they will. Risk factors to this forecast, the upside and downside basically means upside, things could actually be stronger than our outlook. The downside is things could be weaker than our outlook. Macroeconomic policies, we're seeing that I think at the moment, I don't think there's too much of a downside to this. Possibly there's more upside. We have more federal spending going on, although we don't really get a lot in terms of defense spending in the state. There's some indirect, definitely, to companies in Oregon, especially for the high-tech firms. That will be spillover effects to help there. We've also had the some of the stimulus packages that have occurred. We'll mention those in terms of the effect that they have on our taxes. And I understand you will have a more full meeting and discussion of those later today. International conditions. Japan's a very strong trading partner with us. Although there are signs that they're starting to revive, we're also seeing the U.S. dollar starting to slide down just recently. That's good news if it's a nice controlled slide downward. Because our economies are interrelated, what is good for us, a slide down of the U.S. dollar, making our goods look better in terms for our exports. Unfortunately, the other countries, their exports then will look more expensive. So a nice controlled slide would be better here to help our exports without possibly hurting our trading partners. Energy prices, they've come down quite a bit, amazingly so. When you have a situation where you have a speculative bubble and we had high prices here, you have both new generation coming on board and you have people conserving at the same time. We had also the recession, and that backed off on demand. So those prices have come down, although we've seen some very recent prices from natural gas and to PGE electric area. There are expectations that those will be rolled back slightly as their forward contracts, which are in higher prices, start to get renewed at lower prices. The stock market, I showed you this before. It's tough to call which direction this is going in. The bright part, we might say, is that we've taken the hit. We're hopefully now done with that hit, although reverberations of this hit, as Michael will allude to, have occurred on our tax area, because a lot of it is related to what happened in 2001, showed up in April. Mm-hmm. Enronitis, I think the downside here is really national in scope. I don't think it's that much related to PGE being in trouble because of its relationship, but rather the cost of capital rising because people will demand now possibly a premium on profit notices before they'll be willing to buy stocks. Consumer business confidence has gone up nicely. There's a moderate downside here, and I think now that we've seen more reports about possible terrorism attacks again, that weighs on the consumer psychic, and that could hurt their spending patterns, just as the September 11th events did. High-tech industry, very volatile industry. The downside is that it could take a little bit longer for them to get out of this recovery. The upside is that possibly the talk earlier from, say, Intel, saying they were going to add 6,000 employees over the next 15 years, they could speed that possible process up. Another downside part is outsourcing. It seems to be occurring a little bit more often, and China is possibly becoming a semiconductor center, not just for manufacturing, but in the near future for also research needs. And then the longshore work stoppage. The longshore union management dispute possibly could occur this coming July. That's the entire western seaboard, and that would be very disruptive for our exports. And with that, if there's some questions, I can take those quickly on the Oregon economy.
Are there questions on the economic forecast? Representative Wick.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Pulteski, I'm curious about this productivity increase, this 8.6%, I think it was, per year productivity increase during the first quarter. How can you be coming out of a recession and have that kind of an enormous productivity increase, and what does that speak to relative to the economy downstream?
Mr. Chair, Representative Witt, what we have coming out of a recession is that we start to have manufacturing slightly starting to get up. We have other businesses that are looking at the situation and saying, I don't want to be in a position where I hire back a lot of people initially, and if this is not truly a recovery, I don't want to be burdened with that additional cost, if that's not the case. So what I'm going to do as best as possible is I'm going to try to increase my output with a smaller labor force at the moment, work them harder. At the same time, you also have this aspect where even though production is at a lower level, it's also at a much, much lower level of employment working with it. And that tends to raise that productivity level up. The interesting thing about this is that it's at 8.6%. So we're not talking about it at, say, 4%, and then as the recovery happens, we add more people, it drops down to the 2 and 1% range. We should see that 8% start to drop down to something like 4% or to high 3%, which is still very good to help keep a recovery going and not having the wage cost increases being translated into inflationary means.
So you think that's a one-quarter blip to a certain extent because of the high unemployment that was associated with
yes.
a time when production was increasing?
Yes, I do. But like I said, I would be more concerned if it only came out at 4 or 3% at this point.
You indicated on one of the slides that the national economy leading economic indicators up. I thought I read a headline in the last couple of weeks that they were split, half and half, basically, half up, half down.
In my reference, Mr. Chair, I'm thinking of what we've seen in the past 6 months. We had one blip down in April, came down just slightly. Mm-hmm. But I think indications are now, even with consumer confidence, that has now started to come back up for May. And in fact, today, that consumer sentiment index that I mentioned there will have the full May number released. So I'm looking at, I don't want to say a one data point's a trend.
Mm-hmm.
I think the aspect is that that's just a little... a statistical drop, and I expect it to keep continuing going up.
Other questions? Senator.
Mr. Chairman, with your indulgence, I'd like to ask a question not related to the this morning's economic and revenue outlook.
I am so indulgent.
Thank you. Mr. Pulteski, Oregon has created a lot of tax refugees. Notice that we have thousands of working Oregonians relocated into Vancouver, Washington, somewhere. From the Oregon side, we have the same phenomenon all up and down the Columbia, anywhere there's a rich river from Whitehall and the Dalles area. We seem to see a lot of people moving to Dallesport from the Dalles and West Salmon from the river. Milton Freewater has its share of tax refugees. The same phenomenon is true in Ontario, where people can get out of Oregon into Idaho. And I just wondered if there's the same phenomenon is observable in our retiring Oregonians. They work their lives in Oregon and retire into Washington and Idaho. I'm just wondering if there's anything in the statistical reviews or analysis that would calculate the cost of the flight of Oregon taxpayers, Oregon tax refugees. We've got a way to get a handle on what our tax policy is creating in terms of an incentive for people to leave the state of Oregon.
Mr. Chair, Senator Ferriola, there's you can always do a study, and to what extent it's the how good it is going to matter on the data that you have available. Questions you can answer. We have some demographic information of people that at least through driver's license surrendering of where they've moved to, at least by state, and we probably could go even deeper into that to see what that case would be. There's also, I do believe it's a combination. I wouldn't just put it on the tax policy alone. If you look at the Portland metro area, you also have a relatively higher housing prices. And that's because of other consequences, and people seeking, you know, lower housing prices also do so to move in that area. But I think some study like that is possible to take a look at. We have not addressed it in our analysis.
Mr. Chairman, maybe that's something that a topic for a hallway conversation, and maybe a request to the both the Department of Revenue and the State Funds. It seems to me to be. I guess I only have one other question, Mr. Chairman.
Just on that though, it's an interesting one. You can probably get there with some anecdotal information, like you say, with driver's license surrenders and things like that. I would imagine to get the full picture of it, you'd almost take a survey, wouldn't it? There'll be different reasons or multiple reasons for people who are relocating across the river, either from Portland to Vancouver or Milton Freewater to wherever they go across the border there. Walla Walla? Yeah.
Maybe not that far north, but certainly across the river.
But that would almost, wouldn't that almost take a survey kind of approach to nail down what the factors are in consideration?
Mr. Chair, that would be
interesting.
It would be
interesting
a better
survey.
Approach because, mm-hmm. just as you said, there's many reasons for why people have moved, and to be able to assess what their reasons were.
More than half of our prison guards and administrative personnel in some of the prisons in the east side live in Idaho. So, you know, we really looked at the location of prisons in eastern Oregon as an opportunity to diversify the economy of those communities and attach that. But the benefits are being transferred in large part to neighboring states. So I'm just wondering if we're providing some perverse incentive to people in our tax policy, which leads me to my next question.
Sure.
Ordinance number 2 in reliance on personal income tax, the percentage of general fund revenue. And I'm just wondering if a 2% surcharge would take us over into number 1.
Mr. Chair, Senator Farioli, if you're like to defer to Paul to answer that question.
Well, Senator Farioli, we're actually number 1 in reliance on the income tax in terms of percentage of tax revenue, but number 2 is a percent of personal income. One of the things that has happened that's distorted that number a little bit. In the 90s, and referring to the discussion about capital gains, is we have gotten tax dollars collected from capital gains, but capital gains don't show up as personal income in these measures because that's based on current activity. So that's caused us to go up a bit. But if you compare that phenomenon here with our competitor for the number 1 spot, which is New York, it's probably had a bigger effect there. So I suspect that we would have to have a fairly significant increase to go ahead of New York. But I'm not sure of that at that point what the difference is. But that's the state that's consistently been higher than we are, and so we would obviously push up closer to where they are if we had an increase in rates.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a comment for the. From the Governor's Economic Advisory Council. Need a little help here. Have you got any advice for us?
Well, frankly, I don't think where we rank in terms of number 1 and number 2 makes a big difference. I think the question is, in absolute dollars, what does it mean in terms of how does that influence people's decisions as to where to go and where to stay? And if you need anecdotal evidence, I think you just get in your automobile and drive across the interstate bridge and go through Commerce in that area, and the wealth that has transferred from Oregon to Vancouver by itself is all capital gains tax flight money. There is, different people obviously have different reasons to choose where they want to live. But to live under the by the airport where the planes are taking off and right next to the railroad tracks doesn't make a lot of sense to me. But if you see the homes that have been built there, and I know lots of the people who are over there, and they're only over there for one reason, and it's no capital gains taxes.
Thank you.
And if they don't go there, they go to Reno, Nevada. And we are losing not just the tax revenues that would come out of that, but we're losing our leaders. Those are the people who led Oregon's corporations. Now, in terms of the areas that you're talking about and prison guards leaving and so on, I'm not sure whether the tax implications are that critical, because aren't they taxed in the state in which they were? So I'm not sure that that's as meaningful in terms of revenue dollars. Mm-hmm. Where they spend the money, of course, is important. And, you know, and I can just suggest, you know, I was on the board of directors of Costco, and Costco's largest single retail outlet is by the airport in Portland. And it's there because it's near the 205 bridge, and it picks up all the traffic from Vancouver. And very soon they'll be building another store near Janssen Beach, again, for the same reason. So we're picking up that business, but the capital gains taxes that are being lost are enormous, just very substantial. I don't have a number for them. I could just tell you that it's enormous, because I know if I didn't mind getting divorced, I'd be living in Vancouver, you know, today. Well,
you know, this is on, this is being taped.
My wife knows all about this.
Representative Hess.
Thank you. I would just like to comment on the good senator's comment that the Portland School District has a dubious distinction of being number one in the country, too, in terms of the shortest school year in the country now. And I think that has an influence on the behavior not only of individuals but also on business. So I think I just wanted to throw that into your stew.
Although I would suspect that probably a lot of that capital flight is of the older population, and not necessarily the parents of school-aged children.
Yeah, that's correct, Mr. Chairman. It's these are people who are close to retirement or have just retired, and they're basically selling their businesses, and these are the capital gains taxes that they're trying to avoid.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right, let's get on to the revenue forecast then.
Good morning, Senators Walker, Sederle, members of the committee, Senator Ferrioli. For the record, my name is Michael Kennedy. I'm the revenue economist with the Office of Economic Analysis. And I'm going to quickly review the revenue forecast distributed today. I would like to start off by quickly running through the lottery forecast before we get into the general fund revenue situation. The lottery forecast for June is very similar to the March forecast. In fact, earnings are up a mere $1.4 million, and subsequently distributions and other resources from those funds are also very similar. About the only significant change is the additional $32 million in appropriations made in the recent special session that have brought the ending balance down to around $1 million. And this is reflected going out, and actually this chart is not correct. There was a replacement. In fact, the 05/03/05 number is roughly $700 million, or actually it's I think that's correct. In fact, it's about $640 million. Basically, all the revenue, lottery revenue forecasts are similar across the board from March to June, except for that $30 million ending balance is no longer there. It reduces the 03/05 projection. But otherwise, almost everything is basically the same.
So the black bar, the blue bar, should be at what level then?
In fact, I think the 704 is the March number. It's the second two columns there. The blues are actually the marches, and the marches are not on there.
Okay.
The June number would be about 670, roughly down 30 million, and otherwise would be the same except for the ending balance issue. And then the 0507 number would be right around 685. So even going out, the similarity in the earnings for all the lottery games basically continues out into the outer biennium. And that is going to be corrected in the press packet shortly. Okay. So here we see that total resources from the lottery available to the state are basically similar going out into the outer biennia. And the significant issue here to note is just the smaller proportion that's available for general purposes as a result of the dedication for specific programs, including parks and natural resources, education endowment fund, and gambling addiction, to name a few. Now we will move on to the far more interesting general fund picture. Our June forecast, as almost everybody knows, now for the 0103 biennium is down $506 million from the March forecast, and that brings the total general fund revenue shortfall relative to the close of session to $1.37 billion. The majority of the shortfall has occurred in personal income taxes. The current shortfall relative to the previous forecast is about $415 million and has just broken the billion-dollar threshold from the close of session forecast. What I'd like to do now is discuss in a little more detail the reasons for that decline. Primarily, the actuals we're seeing in successive months are basically painting a picture of how the recession and the stock market instability have impacted taxable income in 2001. And it's just becoming progressively more clear that it was far more severe than we would have thought 6 months ago, 3 months ago. The primary driver there is the reduced capital gains income that people earned in 2001 as a result of the stock market instability, the reduced prices, and the volume. In addition, there is evidence to suggest that there are far lower stock option income in last year relative to the expansion years of the late 90s. I'll get more to the capital gains here in a second. Let me just address the other two factors. In the last few months, we've also seen signs of additional weakness, some weakness in the collections that are actually associated with the current tax year, 2002. So that has also led us going forward to reduce the forecast a little bit in collections.
Would that be estimated taxes, withholding, what is it?
Withholding and estimated taxes, and primarily estimated taxes, as withholding has basically bounced around our previous forecast. This is probably a sign that as we see more of what revenues or what collections actually look like for 01 and this recent tax period, I'm basically associating a new idea of what collections look like with basically what we know about economic activity. Was creating a lower base from which the same recovery would extend from, and thus results in somewhat lower collections associated going out over time. And finally, as we know, the federal stimulus package allowed for the bonus depreciation allowance, and in fact, some of that falls in the personal income tax as small businesses, S corporations, also can avail themselves of that allowance. To address capital gains a little more, between 1980 and the year 2000 presented here, capital gains grew as a share of gross income from about 2% to over 8%, as you can see here. And that has significant consequences, because as we can see, the green bars our personal income growth has changed year over year, and personal income growth tends to be fairly stable. In contrast, capital gains income tends to be very volatile, as the stock market is equally volatile. And so as a greater proportion of your taxable income becomes based on capital gains, you're going to see more instability in your revenue stream over time. In fact, our current forecast builds in a 32% decline in capital gains income for the 2001 tax liability year, which then is feeding into what we've just seen in April and May, and in fact has a further 12% reduction in 2002, the tax year, which will play out through mid-2003. Finally, a very preliminary tax return information shows that the 8.6% share figure in the previous chart for 2001 could be as low as 1%. It is just significantly farther down than anybody would have expected.
Riding a bucking bronco.
Continuing on, in addition, corporate income taxes have been revised downward $111 million relative to the March forecast and are now $335 million below closing session. Make a similar detailed look. The majority of that decline, $111 million, is the result of the bonus depreciation allowance. Roughly $88 million in this biennium is the result of that allowance.
That's on the corporate side.
Corporate side. And thus, the remainder of the 124 is on the personal income side. And similarly to the personal income side, the idea of there being a lower base of revenues that we now actually know about, thus the recovery from there also results in slightly lower, although very considerably lower than on the personal income side, lower revenue numbers going out over time. And in addition, although much slighter than personal income taxes, there is a little bit of weakness in the advance payments that firms are making in this current tax year. So those have also been factored in going forward. Now, in terms of total general fund resources, that results in lower revenue projections going out into the future biennium, roughly $450 million lower in 2003-2005 and about $500 million lower in 2005-2007. Now, in terms of the long-term trend, however, there is still considerable growth in revenue projections going out over time. It's just that it's not nearly as steep as one would have thought back in 2000, 2001 on the heels of the expansion. Now, looking at percentage change, we're now looking at the current biennium being 3.8% below general fund revenues for 9901. But then to rebound in the next biennium up 18.4%.
Oh, I just want to stop on that for a minute. So looking at this chart, we're looking back historically back to 1979, and this is the first and projecting in, at least into the next several years, the only biennium that we're actually expecting to see, that we have seen and expect to see an actual decline in general fund revenues from one biennium to the next in hard dollars?
Mr. Chair, one thing to remember is that in the 81-83 biennium, actions were taken to address the revenue shortfall that then propped those revenues back up. What we do not know here is at some point in the midpoint without those, what would the picture have looked like? And it's pretty likely that it would have been negative, I'm assuming.
I could figure it in my head, but I don't want to. no, what's the 3.8%? What's that translate to in terms of dollars? Oh, so you can't do it either.
$100 million if you look at the chart above. 10.12 to 9.2.
Is that it? Okay.
Yeah, about 400.
400?
Mm-hmm. 10.1.
Yeah, about 400. Yeah.
Oh, yes. 400 million. 3.8%.
Okay.
And then over time, the growth rate in the outer biennium comes back down to the historic, roughly in line with the historic growth rate. Now, two things to remember, that 3.8% decline is also partially a function of the kicker distributed in this year, which being larger than the kicker distributed in the previous biennium results in some of that drop being just the result of that refund distribution. And similarly, then the 18.4% is overstating the true growth because there is no kicker projected in next biennium's figure. Now, to do that a little bit further, this chart then presents the white are the same growth figures you just saw in the previous graph, and the blue are now adjusted for kicker refunds, federal pension refunds, etc. So the true decline is about 2% relative to the last biennium, and we're projecting in reality about a 14.2% increase in revenues into the next biennium. Now, there are a few risks to this forecast, and as Tom has noted, there are a number of risks to the economic forecast, and based on whether the economy could come out faster or slower than what we projected, that would have similar implications for the revenue picture. As we've already addressed as well, capital gains by composing a larger share and being volatile, we are a little more at the mercy of where the stock market's going to go. And as Tom has implied, that's pretty much up in the air right now. We're not quite sure how it's going to settle out. And finally, there are some possible tax law changes that would obviously change these numbers considerably. One possibility is that the federal government reacts to the Enron and Arthur Andersen situation with laws or increased reporting or alternative reporting that could affect corporate earnings statements and corporate earnings liability. And in addition, we are looking at the federal stimulus package, and one possibility raised has been an add back or a disconnect from that. So depending on whether those things happen or not, obviously our numbers would change. Finally, it may be moot at this point, but we will look at the kicker calculation. And at this moment...
Is it just for the fun of it, right?
Certainly.
Yeah.
Just in case anybody's counting on that for Christmas next year. We are currently about $1.2 billion short of what the threshold would be to cause a kicker refund. Now, while that seems impossible, obviously any general fund revenue actions taken, significant actions taken, I mean, it's theoretically possible, you could come back up and meet that, however unlikely. And as for the corporate as well, it's down 350 from the threshold, which is obviously calculated 2% above what the close of session forecasted was. That concludes my presentation.
Questions? Tom, we heard from Roger Brenner here about, a month ago, and I sat through that presentation, and I guess I would say his economic forecast anyway, I don't think he got so much into revenue forecast, but his economic forecast was decidedly more upbeat than what we've seen here, and I guess, I know you were at that presentation, I guess I'd appreciate some comments as to where you depart from Dr. Brenner's economic forecast and what the prevailing thinking is on that subject.
Mr. Chair, Dr. Brenner reported, gave a interesting presentation, as you said, about a month ago, and his presentation was, as I would characterize it, was extremely Keynesian in nature. And what this means
usually Keynesian people were more Keynes than Keynes was, which meant that they disregarded certain other policies and felt that if you had federal government spending, drop taxes, this would be extremely, extremely stimulative to an economy. And I think you really think he went on those lines of saying, look, you know, we've got these stimulus packages that are out there. It's more stimulus than we've seen in a long time. This is really going to push the economy up to very, very fast rates. My differing with that is if we think the U.S. economy is going to go supernova, and then that's going to pull all the states up with it, the U.S. economy overall had one of the mildest recessions on record. It's almost, you know, how much farther can you push consumers to increase their spending when they've already kept it up quite high, even in the face of this recession? So the other areas of and refinancing, it's already taken place. The people that have done that, housing, buying, construction, those are all at high levels. I don't see how you can have a huge more expansion of those in terms of the economy. So in terms of his look, I think, yes, we're in recovery and we're going to have growth, but not to the extent that he believed, which also then spilled over of saying that taxes are just going to be pulled up along with this supernova growth of the economy.
Well, now, Dr. Brenner comes from DRI WIFA, which is one of the firms that you rely on for your national forecasting. Does his personal presentation not jive with what you're getting from DRI WIFA, or does it just not wash out with all the other information that you get? Explain that to me, I guess.
Mr. Chair, Dr. Brenner has his own company,
yeah,
and he works in concert with DRI WIFA on various projects. And this I took as being from his company only point of view. It does not really jive with the DRI WIFA look for the U.S. economy.
Mr. Chairman, if I might suggest, when you take a look at the breakdown of the Oregon economy versus the national economy, you see certain differences. One of those differences certainly is the role that manufacturing plays in our state, particularly in high technology. And a real swing factor for our state in terms of employment as well as revenues will be how the high technology industry recovers from the recession that they've been in. They've been in a much deeper recession in the last 18 months than the overall American economy. As you look forward, that's expected to improve, but we just saw yesterday, for example, that Intel cut its average microprocessor price by 53%, and along with that price reduction, announced that the personal computer sales were not doing very well. In other words, they were still relatively sluggish.
Mm-hmm.
So I would suggest that if you read into that, since that's an important factor, Intel being the largest manufacturing employer in the state, that they're going to be slow to add a lot of employees in the state until that picture begins to clear up. In addition to that, we are subject, despite the fact we have a fairly diverse high technology or electronics industry within the state, individual companies are always subject to either product obsolescence or competitive threats in areas that might affect a particular company here in the state. Intel's second largest product is what you would find in your cell phones and your digital cameras. It's called flash memory. And that's a very big product for them. Well, its largest competitor in that area just introduced brand new technology at lower prices. And so the question then that has to be extended from that is, how does that influence Intel? We know one thing. Cellular telephone business generally is more sluggish than was expected as recently as a month ago. And now we have competition for those components. Second factor is that in the cellular telephone area, TriQuint, which is a big employer in Washington County, depends very heavily on the cellular telephone business. And in that particular area, new materials have come in, new technology has come in, And that raises the question as to where TriQuint is going to go from here. There was an article in the Oregonian this morning on TriQuint, which I did not have a chance to read, but it may address those points. In the short term, in the truck manufacturing business, Freightliner, which went into a severe recession because of let's call it flawed policies in terms of pricing of trucks, and laid off lots of people, now is bringing people back because demand for trucks is very strong. Very strong because there's a new federal law that's coming into play in the fall that will increase the price of trucks by several thousand dollars. So you're seeing a lot of orders coming in today. Well, it's when you have a lot of orders coming in today, more than you expect, then I would expect that after September, the orders will probably go on over the other side, which will have a significant effect on that particular segment of the economy. So as you look at our economy, it's different than the national economy. We don't have as big, in terms of the swings, you know, manufacturing, particularly in these areas, is much more important than it is in the national economy. And at this particular moment, those areas are at best uncertain.
You know, that raises one other question, I guess, in my mind. I appreciate comments from any of you. You said, you know, and I've read this too, on the national level, the recession is very mild. And yet, when I read the magazines we get, you know, Governing Magazine and the NCSL magazine, I'm not reading about any states that are doing well at all. They're all at the state level, state by state, the economies seem to be in deeper trouble than the national economy. Why isn't it that, why does it seem to be that on a state-by-state level, all the states seem to be in worse condition than the national economy? It seems like there ought to be some averaging there where somebody ought to be doing well in this to be bringing that national economy up, but it doesn't seem to be happening. What's going on there? Are there some big winners out there that we're just not paying attention to?
It was a recession,
yeah,
and it did affect all the states. Some states fared a little better. When we started to see some of these energy prices going up quite dramatically, places like Wyoming were doing further exploration for either methane gases, all sorts of things. That was starting to prop their economy up a little bit. Some of the other energy-dependent states did a little bit better during this time. But still, overall, the drops that have happened, the drops of employment, are not anywhere near as bad as we've seen in previous recessions for these states. So they're all doing worse, but relative to previous recessions, they're not as bad off. The thing that you may see in, like, Governing Magazine, it's all the red ink in terms of state budgets. And the difference here is that the type of either spending because of capital gains or income tax revenue because of capital gains, those weren't necessarily such collapses in past recessions as it was during this one. And that is what we're seeing, that even though we're seeing the mildness coming from the recession, supposedly, other states, although Oregon, as we said, got hit a little harder, the revenue drop is really related to some of those stock option capital gains and both the spending and income taxes that resulted from those.
Okay. Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Potowski, I mean, isn't it true, though, that during this recession, which has been fairly mild, consumer spending held up pretty well? Things like auto sales, home construction held up quite well. So on the business side, the business investment went down, particularly in terms of capital goods and equipment. So getting back to the economist who made the presentation earlier that the chairman was referring to, it would seem to me that the key in terms of coming out of the recession and having sustained economic growth is dependent upon policies and an environment that will once again create a greater opportunity and incentive for business to make capital investment, which will lead to the kind of productivity gains and ultimately will lead to rising employment along with those productivity gains to provide for a sustained recovery.
Mr. Chair, Representative Witt, that is correct. I agree with you. You want to keep in mind businesses want to make investments if they can make a return on them. And if we have a particular tax policy such that we can set an environment which is encouraging, that will help. But a tax break on a business investment that you don't think is going to give you any return because there's not demand out there isn't going to help much. It helps to set the environment. And then if somehow, you know, we get the consumer confidence back, we're slowly seeing the spending coming, then we will see, and this is what tends to be the later stages of a recovery, the business investment is one of the later parts to come up. That's one of the reasons why we think Oregon, because our specialty in a sense is providing goods for business investments, will lag what the U.S. economy is doing.
Can I add, Representative, the average manufacturing facility in the United States, called operating rate, is in the low 70s. So in other words, we can expand, theoretically, if all of that was modern, you know, those were modern facilities, we could expand by almost 50%, expand the output by almost 50% without needing any additional facilities. So one of the things that we have to concern ourselves with is this surplus capacity.
Mm-hmm.
I would suspect that a lot of the electronics facilities, in Oregon, are probably operating at 50 to 60% of their real capacity to produce goods, because there's still a lot of inventory in the pipeline that has to be used up. And that's part of what caused the deeper recession in our area.
I think the perfect example of that in my ad, Ralph, you have the Fujitsu plant is just sitting out there, empty. And if demand starts up, they can start to walk right in there with very little probably changes and get that thing operating again.
Isn't the strong dollar having a particularly negative impact on Oregon, where we are so dependent upon export, particularly of capital goods and high technology products? And, I mean, what do you foresee in terms of the dollar versus both European and Asian currencies over the next 6 to 12 months? And what kind of impact might that have on particularly manufacturing for export here in Oregon?
Mr. Chair, Representative Witt, it looks like we're in a situation where the strong dollar just can't be sustained. In fact, recently we started to see some sliding down of the dollar. The forecast, the DRI WEFA people also believe that it's going to be sliding down over time, actually over the next 12 months. That should be beneficial to our manufacturers here, making our exports look relatively cheaper out in the world than they did before at the much stronger dollar. The controlled fall here is that those countries that also their economies are starting to revive, like in Asia, their currency is getting much stronger against the U.S. dollar too quickly, could possibly disrupt their recovery. And so there's a point here where I believe the dollar has been overvalued. It should probably be at a lower level. If it can reach that at a 90-controlled fall, we should be okay, and it should be stimulative for our exports.
Eric, join in, if I might add. You know, keep in mind that our primary trade imbalance is no longer, you know, we still have Japan and we still have, to some degree, the European community, but our biggest problem are places like China, Taiwan, Korea, Singapore, now the Philippines, for example, and we're going to need a major change in our currency relationships before China becomes non-competitive with American products. We're a long, long way from being competitive. And if I might add, I think if one wanted to be concerned longer term, you have to look at what Tom earlier mentioned, and that is that China, for example, is becoming a center of product development, not just product manufacturing. Intel just made major announcements of building a large research and development facility in China. They announced a large expansion of their facilities in Monterrey, Mexico, and they just announced a major increase in research facilities in the Philippines. To give you a sense, the Philippines graduate some 70,000 engineers every year. And these engineers make what, in our state, we pay for unemployment. In fact, we pay more for unemployment for those who are unemployed than people who are engineers make in the Philippines. And they're turning out to be pretty good engineers. Vietnam, for example, just as another example, said that they will be having 50,000 software engineers within the next 3 years. They will make something like 20% of what software engineers make in India. And then you say, well, are they any good? Well, their customers right now are Sony, IBM, Matsushita. They're all the big worldwide companies because these engineers are very good. And that's our biggest concern, that companies that are headquartered in the United States, and particularly companies that are competing in technologies that are fluid, in other words, where what's new technology today becomes a commodity 2 or 3 years from today, it'll be a real problem for us. Because if we're going to focus on those businesses that have this kind of turnover in terms of technology, and that's what we're going to depend upon, if they're not going to do their development here, we're in trouble.
Well, yeah, let me just ask this, and I'm almost afraid of the answer. But then, if we are under capacity in manufacturing, so that mm-hmm. We're not looking at a big expansion in manufacturing, and if manufacturing is moving offshore as it has, and now research and development is moving offshore, what's left?
Well, I think that's the question.
No, I want the answer.
Well, I don't have the answer. I want to tell you what's left. What's left is what is going to be produced by our educational institutions. And so then I can turn around, I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, and say to you,
yeah.
What's left? You know, if our educational institutions cannot produce competitive engineers, competitive graduates, then what we are will be a third world nation. If you go back to the 1980-81 period, when we had a very severe recession and we had very high interest rates, and this state had one of the highest unemployment rates in the nation, if I'm sure you recall that Eugene, for example, in 1982 had a 22% unemployment rate. And the state of Oregon's unemployment rate came very close to 13%. And I would imagine that some of the communities that were dependent upon forest products, the unemployment rate was 40 to 50%. And then so the question is, all right, well, that was replaced by a massive increase in population that came into the state, basically employed by the electronics engineering community, the Intels of the world. And if those companies now go through the same period, same kind of environment that the forest products companies went in, the question is what replaces them. And if we are now a high-cost manufacturing state and we don't have the production of graduates out of our universities that can develop new products and are entrepreneurial at the same time, then I think it speaks for itself. We will end up as a low-income state, and we will be a third-world country.
Well, this isn't just the state. This is national. It is a national issue.
But it's obviously national. It's also, but if you take a look at what we're dependent upon,
mm-hmm. Here in Oregon, yeah.
Here in Oregon, you know, and so I would suggest that's, you know, that deserves a lot of thought, because let me just give you one example, and I know this sounds terribly negative of what I'm saying, but LSI Logic, we were very proud of the fact that LSI Logic, a big custom chip maker, was coming to Oregon and built a brand new facility. LSI Logic just signed with Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing approximately a month ago to develop all of its new chips and to manufacture all of its new latest technology chips in Taiwan. Now, that's a hint, in my opinion, of what's taking place. And we have to follow that and make sure, you know, that we understand the implications of that. Hopefully it's not just LSI Logic, but Epson suggests maybe LSI Logic is not a leader, but maybe even a little bit of a follower. Hewlett Packard Printers, formerly made over in Vancouver, now being made in Asia. InFocus saying, having built the brand new facility in Wilsonville, saying they can't compete cost-wise anymore because projectors don't sell for $6,000. They now sell for $3,000, and they can't compete.
Is that primarily cost of labor?
It's primarily cost of labor.
So I guess the question that I'm almost afraid to have this answer to then is, if we produce the number of engineers that you're speaking, you know, that we need to produce engineers and high-skilled people, are they going to be, are we talking about now the same issue, cost of labor, where you can get the same, you can get engineers in Vietnam and India and Taiwan? Are we going to be competitive, or are we just putting out people who are overpriced in the market?
You know, the question really, I think that goes to a question of what do you call high technology or new technology? In other words, and what I'm suggesting is that what is being produced in Asia today in terms of InFocus is commodity technology. In other words, what we need to be able to, we need to be on the leading edge of developing new technology, which is what this country has always been able to accomplish. If we're not on the leading edge in terms of new technology, where the profit margins are high and labor costs are relatively incidental relative to the price, then your concerns are my concerns.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah, Mr. Hess.
Thank you. I guess to follow this is a very interesting discussion. I think it's critically important. What would your recipe for success then be, to invest more in higher education, or how do you deal with looking at this day 20 or 30 years from now in terms of not losing all of its engineers, or not producing engineers, or what is the moral of this story?
Well, I think, Representative, I think you have to go right back to basics, and that is we have to produce not just more engineers, you have to produce the highest quality engineers, the most entrepreneurial engineers, and that means you have to do that in our own universities. Now, and that's not a short-term phenomenon, obviously. I mean, that's not something you can handle overnight. You know, I was asked to go on an advisory committee for one of our engineering schools. And I was asked, so I said, yeah, that's a real nice compliment. Tell me, what are you going to do to make your school a better engineering school? And they said, well, we're going to offer 150 scholarships. And I said, golly, that's a lot of scholarships. That's really an aggressive position to take. You know, that's terrific. How are you going to choose the people who get the scholarships? Diversity. I said, what? What do you mean diversity? You mean some people working in semiconductor memory and some people in semiconductor in microprocessors? No, diversity. People who couldn't get into engineering school otherwise will come into engineering school because we'll give them a scholarship. And I said, do you think that Intel is going to hire people from graduating from your university because of diversity? I mean, Intel is as diverse as they come. I mean, most of those people who are now hiring come from India, come from Taiwan. You know, they are really diverse. An engineering school is not going to build a reputation or graduate students that are going to be competitive worldwide on the basis of diversity. It may be socially attractive for a very short period of time, but they're not going to get jobs when they come out. So I said, you have to go out and you have to search out through the entire nation, throughout the entire globe, for the best students. And that's who you give your scholarships to. And then you have to hire the best professors. And that's how you go ahead and spend the money that you're going to spend on education. Back in 81, 82, I had been here only a half dozen years, and I recall how we fixed our budget deficit with higher education cuts, and we cut electrical engineering the same amount that we cut forest products. And I couldn't understand that, because every engineering graduate could get a job, but every forest products graduate was going to be unemployed. I didn't understand that. To me, you have to be pragmatic. If we're going to build the kind of higher education system that's going to be competitive worldwide, we have to have the best people in the best in those areas that we think will grow. And unfortunately, what I see is we're going the opposite direction. We're cutting back on those, you know, on the outlays for those in those areas, and we're offering scholarships for reasons other than merit. And, you know, I can assure you, I give a lot of money to organizations, you know, that support people who are underprivileged. And that's a pleasure on my part, because I feel I have that obligation. But I sure don't feel I have an obligation to support a diversity program in the engineering world, just like I wouldn't support a diversity program in the medical world. I'd hate to go, you know, I don't think any of us would like to go to the doctor who wouldn't have been able to go to medical school, not because that doctor couldn't afford it, but because, you know, or was accepted to medical school, not because of merit, not because of capability, but because he or she belonged to a particular ethnic group. You know, the same thing is true for companies buying products or hiring people out of universities. So you know, we have an opportunity. Let me just, you know, we're off on a large tangent here, I'm sorry. But we have an opportunity. We're going to be spending, for example, in the area of development of new companies, you know, my understanding, somewhere between $15 and $30 million of the lottery money is going to go into venture capital. That's the business I'm in. I was on the founding board of the Oregon Resource and Technology Development Fund. In all of that period of time that I was on the board there, we saw virtually no technology transfer from the universities, any of the universities, that created new companies. If we're going to spend $15 million or $30 million, depending upon what, you know, what number, you know, you accept, but $15 million, I understand, is the minimum, and said we're going to go to Mentor Graphics, for example, which is a world leader in this particular technology, and said, name three of the top professors in the world that you think, if we brought those professors to Oregon State or Portland State, and we said, you know, we're going to give you an endowment to do the kind of work you want, and to hire and to be able to bring in the graduate students from anywhere in the world that you would like to bring in, and you asked Mentor Graphics to go ahead and identify those people, and then you said to them, and would you support these people with contracts? Would you hire people, you know, on an internship basis? My guess is they would jump at the chance. And all of a sudden, we'd become a world leader in electronic design. Not a world leader in engineering, a world leader in electronic design. And then if we did it in displays, because we also have very strong display technology, we'd be a world leader in displays. But if we try to hire one person in semiconductor manufacturing and one person in artificial intelligence and so on, which is what we've been doing, you end up being mediocre in everything, because you don't have enough depth and resources being committed to what we're... That's what we need to do. So, you know, you asked the wrong question.
You asked.
You asked. There it is.
Representative Beck, we've got to get back on schedule here, but go ahead.
Well, I think it's a great discussion, and it's good to have someone as informed as you clearly are in this building with... isn't one of the usual lobbyists who comes down here. I'm glad you're here. So, we have a choice. And we hear conflicting things that we have to increase taxes to solve our problem. We're going to negatively impact the business climate here. And yet you're also telling us if we don't make the investments that we need to make, we're and we haven't been making them for the last 10 years, if we don't start making those investments, we're doomed as well. So weighing those two, raising taxes and maybe impacting the business climate and not making the investments we haven't been making, what do we do? Do we need to raise taxes and increase investments, or some other, just cut our budget, cut investments in higher ed and basic education and not make any new investments, but keep the business climate a little stronger for lack of new taxes?
Well, Mr. Representative, let me suggest that, the way I look at things is the way I look at things has the effect as I would handle them, right? Let's assume my income in my own household was below what it had been in the past.
Yeah.
And I had to make some decisions. Well, what I would do is I'd sit down and see what I spent in the past that I don't need to spend in the next period going forward. It's setting new priorities. And I think that I suspect that just like in our household, when times are good, God, I tell you, we waste a lot of money. You know, I mean, it's amazing how much, I say, all right, we don't have to use coupons at the grocery store anymore, and all right, Costco's too far away, so you can shop at some higher price store in town and so on. But times get tough, and all of a sudden I say, well, listen, it costs an extra 15 cents for gasoline to drive another 10 miles, but you're going to save $25 on your week's groceries. Drive that extra 15 cents, worth of gas and mileage and do that. I suspect, and I'm not an expert, so please, I may be all wrong, but I suspect that setting of priorities has been, sort of, when you divide up the picture into so many little pieces, everybody has priorities. But in terms of looking at the whole thing as a total picture, priorities may not have been set the way they would be in a tough environment. And I want to suggest that that's what we would do. We'll end up making decisions on the basis of new priorities which would not have been considered before. I'm going to use as that example. Do we need to spend lottery dollars on creating venture capital opportunities when for 20 years the venture capital opportunities have done nothing but lose money? We have 22 companies left in the Oregon Resource and Technology Development Account. 22 companies. The gentleman who was called in to analyze those companies, when he finished the job, called me and he said, I'm looking for a new work. Can you help me out? And I said, well, what have you done lately? And he told me what he was doing. I said, well, by golly, that's a lot of companies. How are they doing? He said, they all should be put to bed. No, put to sleep is what he said. Now, you look at that and you say, well, wait a second. Is that a good place to spend money? Keep in mind that last year, Oregon State University had 2 patents, University of Oregon had 1 patent, Portland State University had 0 patents, Oregon Graduate Institute had 0 patents, and that's what we're starting new businesses on. Okay? So if you don't have the technology that's worthwhile getting patents on, then why do you want to start businesses on based on technology that isn't unique enough to get a patent on? But it sounds good. Theoretically, that's how you start new businesses. That's how we ended up in the venture capital business. We were in the same kind of environment that we're in today. But then we had 2 big universities here in the state, and one was Tektronix and the other was Intel. And they were spinning off graduates one after the other, starting new businesses. Today, Tektronix is no longer 25,000 people. It's less than 3,000 in the state. Intel is no longer spinning off people. They're doing it all internally and not with great success, but they've got $30 billion, so, you know, they're not worried about it yet, but they will be. So what we're doing is we're going to put $15 or $20 or $30 billion into new venture capital deals in an environment where that, if we spent that on bringing in 6 or 7 or 10 new professors, world-class professors with their PhD students, we may really have something. I'd rather bet my money on the latter than on the former. That's priorities.
Good answer.
I hate to wrap this up because it's been engaging.
Oh,
okay, Representative Nolan.
Thank you, Mr.
Yeah.
Chair, for your
input. No, that's all right. It's all right. It's fair.
Mr. Shaw, I hear the analogy to a household budget a lot, and as both the household budget person and a business owner, I'm not sure the analogy to a household budget is as useful as the analogy to a business. In my experience, which does not match yours, I've never found that you grow a business by cutting it so much as you grow a business by putting money into opportunities, and particularly in downtimes. You don't ever cut your way out of a business slump. You grow it out by making astute investments. And so I'd like, because the chair's in a hurry, if you could spend just a few minutes making the analogy to our situation here to a business investment analogy rather than a household, and how you would help us both identify what programs, not specifics, but how to identify programs that we could do without, but also how to identify opportunities that are worth investing in to grow out of this problem instead of cut our way out of it.
Representative, I've had a lot of experience in working with companies that have run out of money and have failed to meet their objectives and have to go back and rethink. In fact, I just spent yesterday afternoon with a company that had that kind of a problem. And what I suggested to them is what I would suggest to anybody in this situation, and that is, one has to go back and take a look at their real assets. And what I mean by real assets is not an accounting definition of assets. It's people, it's ingenuity, it's imagination, it's marketing channels, it's the kind of thing, a lot of which are, it may be considered intangibles by an accountant, but not intangibles in terms of a business operator or somebody in government. You're absolutely correct. What you'll find coming out of this recession, in particularly in the so-called high technology businesses, is great innovation. Because people will realize you cannot, where you used to be able to sell a memory chip for $90 and you now get $1.90 for it, the fact that you can produce more at $1.90 isn't going to make you successful. What you have to do is produce a new kind of memory chip that might get you $90 again. I mean, that's Intel's situation. They have to continuously obsolete what they have. And during this period of difficult times is when the greatest innovation takes place. Because what people do is they set priorities. That's why LSI Logic said, our great strength isn't manufacturing. Our great strength is innovation and design. So Taiwan Semiconductor can manufacture just as well as we can, maybe even better. So we'll let them do the manufacturing. And we won't have to spend all the capital dollars to build manufacturing facilities. Let them spend it. They'll make smaller margins, profit margins, and that's what we'll do. So I think we as a state really should get together and define as best we can what our strengths are. As Senator Ferrioli knows, just a week or so ago, I talked about what our weaknesses were, we have to sit down and determine what our strengths are and then put our capital dollars and our operating dollars behind those strengths. That's, if we're going to be competitive, we're not going to be competitive across the board. we're not going to be, I mean, just specifically, we're not, again, not going to be competitive in building a world-class engineering university with the amount of capital that we have available. Not likely to happen. But we could be world-class in specific areas where we have great capabilities. Think about who are the leaders in various industries that reside here in the state. If we took those particular areas and focused on them, perhaps we could build world-class centers of excellence in those areas. And interestingly enough, those spin off other areas. So it's just like being a farmer. You know, it's, you know, you're planting seeds, hoping that they're going to be growing, but making sure you cultivate them and water them and support them all along. But you don't go ahead and use generic seeds if you want to compete. You need to go ahead and use new genetic seeds that will eliminate the problems that you might have with disease or weeds or what have you. That's what we need to do. We need to identify the areas of strength, and we have areas of strength. We're amongst the leaders in the world in electronic device technology design. We're among the leaders of the world in display technology. You know, we're among the leaders in the world in the semiconductor test technology. We're among the leaders in the world in instrumentation technology. But I haven't seen any initiative saying, well, if we're leaders in the world in those areas, and those areas are likely to still be needed 10 years from today, let's focus on those areas and make them even better. I don't hear that. But I'm going to suggest that's what we should do, because I believe that's our strength. Those are our strengths, and if we focused on that, they'll be our strengths down the road. And that's what we'll build a vibrant economy around.
Senator Farioli, and then I think it will be 10 o'clock.
Thank you. What I'm hearing very clearly is that higher education is not strategically connected to economic objectives. And I think what we have tried to do with new investment in Oregon with health sciences universities is take our first all these steps toward making that connection. And it's a grand experiment. We're not very comfortable with it and really don't know what the success curve might be. But we have not given higher education the directive to connect itself with any economic objectives. You know, we expect our institutions of higher learning to turn out well-rounded. And I think they do that. But I'm not sure that they would come to the legislature and sell themselves as the new economic engines of the world. And so I wonder if, as a policy, the legislature in higher education ought not to sit down and decide how it is that we strategically connect higher education objectives to economic objectives.
Well, do you think the passage of Measure 10 and Measure 11 move us in that direction?
I think those are experiments. They are obviously things that Oregonians thought we ought to do. But I hear a caveat. I hear a warning in what Mr. Shaw said today. And I guess I'll bring it back to the issue of tax policy. Tax policy is not really connected strategically to economic growth in Oregon. As a matter of fact, it is connected to anti-growth in Oregon. We automatically have a 9% spike that other states don't have in capital gains. But I'm wondering if we don't need to look very carefully about what happens if we make the strategic investment in higher education that's warranted. If we don't do something to incent the patents and the products and the new businesses to be located here, to use the workforce here, to use the infrastructure here, then what we'll end up doing is what we're doing now. Excellent students and graduates are our primary export products in Oregon education systems. They go elsewhere to work. They go elsewhere to develop their products. We make the investment. We identify the excellent students in our systems and then make them recruitment targets for the world. And those folks respond to those incentives and they tend to go elsewhere. if we don't restructure the tax system in Oregon to make sure that the people that develop the patents and the products and start the new businesses want to locate here and take advantage of Oregon infrastructure and workforce, then that investment won't pay the dividend that we hope it will. So I'm going to suggest that connecting higher ed strategically to economic objectives and connecting tax policy strategically to economic growth, which is a big change in direction for Oregon, are both necessary. I don't think we solve our problems just by quadrupling our investment in high technology, higher education, without doing anything to the tax structure and the other business climate structures to incent people that develop those products to stay here. I am also particularly worried about this. If we develop this brave new world of technocracy and engineering skills and entrepreneurial skills, where is the labor force in Oregon to fit there? Where do the blue-collar, middle-class Oregonian families fit there? And Mr. Shaw's talking about the slide towards third world demographics. Half of the state's already in third world demographics. Rural Oregon has half the per capita income, a far higher poverty rate per capita than the urban areas, more hunger, less education, more of the down indicators that you see in some of the more depressed areas of the country. We've already got those conditions in about half the state of Oregon. And so I worry that our focus on higher education, high technology, and investment and restructuring leaves a lot of Oregonians out of this equation. And I guess I wonder if we don't understand that our focus or our lack of focus in strategic economic development and strategic educational development and tax policy has led us to where we are. We have a very fragile economy. You know, if you look back over Oregon's history, it was the forest products industry that capitalized our move into high technology. We were harvesting 5.5 billion board feet off federal forests throughout the 80s. And a lot of that capital that piled up were the dollars that we used when the forest products industry downturn. Those are the dollars that we used to build the infrastructure needed to transfer in high technologies to Oregon. We're not in the same shape that we were in. You know, we don't have a cash cow to turn around and reinvest in the next wave, the next thing, the next technology. And I really worry that we systemically damaged rural Oregon to the point where I'm not sure what recovers that segment of our state. I'm worried that if we make the investments that Mr. Shaw indicates and I agree with in higher education and technology, but if we fail to restructure the other stuff around that, including tax policy and just the bureaucratic approach that we have to developing in Oregon. I mean, you can't find land to develop in Oregon. That's one of the big problems that we have. If we don't deal with those other restructurings at the same time, no amount of investment in high technology is going to get us out of the hole that we're in.
Okay, I hate to wrap this up because it's been very stimulating, but we do have another few items on the agenda to get to. I want to thank you, Shaw.
Pleasure.
Tom, for, as always, welcome to the world of the House Revenue Committee. Welcome back. Let's take a break. We'll reconvene at 11 o'clock. We'll try and move some things around on the agenda. At 11, we will take up the review of the ballot measures and the school revenue situation. We can defer any committee business until later in the agenda. So we'll take a break for 12 minutes and reconvene promptly at 11 o'clock.